Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 126, recorded August 26, 2011. The good, the bad, and the ugly. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, and we've got a fantastic panel of folks with us this week to talk about the incredible developments in the world of technology and the law that have been going on and that affect all of our lives every day, the more and more that technology becomes part of those lives. We've got one of our favorite guests back with us today. We've got Professor Eric Goldman. Hello, Eric.
Hi, glad to be back.
Never not awesome when you're on, so thrilled to have you. And also joining us for the first time, we have e-commerce lawyer in Washington, D.C., David Sneed. Hello, David.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing really well.
I'm excited and a little bit intimidated to be here today.
Oh, please don't be intimidated at all. We're just thrilled to pick your brain on the various things that we want to discuss. And one of the most timely and topical things I think we've got on our agenda for today is Facebook's privacy changes that came out this week, changes to its privacy controls that have been long anticipated and clamped down on, I think, probably the single biggest change that's gotten the most coverage this week is the fact that you no longer can be tagged in somebody's post without approving it. So a lot of people are saying that many of Facebook's privacy changes emulated what Google Plus had in place when it came out the door. Others have said, and I think it was Larry Magid I read, that they were on Facebook's privacy council and that these changes were being discussed months before Google Plus came out. So one way or the other, whether it's being the sincerest form of flattery or just good policy, Facebook has decided to make some changes. And the most notable thing for me is that, you know, I've clamped down my Facebook page so much based on how it's operated to date that it really doesn't matter much to me. I mean, it would just be more work for me to go in and figure out the new privacy settings and begin to apply them. Although I suppose I'll just have to bite the bullet and do it at some point. Evan, have you taken a look and are you assured that Facebook has now become more user-friendly on the privacy front?
Well, this is a great idea for Facebook to do this. And I really do hope, as Larry Magid was writing, and he's, you know, involved, as you said, in kind of the decision-making policy level or advising Facebook, you know, that this photo tagging thing is a good idea. That being the requiring a person's approval before a photo of them going up, the tag is attached to that and is made available for everything to see. So, you know, it's long overdue. It should have always been this way because that's one of the big complaints that people have had for years about Facebook. It's like, oh, these photos, these embarrassing photos are going to end up and I'm going to not have any control over who sees that. And, you know, to a certain extent, there was no control whatsoever. You know, if you indeed were a member of Facebook and your identity was associated with that, it was made available to so many other folks here. When I saw that Facebook had implemented this change, I was reminded of a case that came out earlier this year. I think it was from a court in Kentucky, and the issue in the case was whether or not there had been a misappropriation of a right of one of the litigants' right of privacy because somebody had tagged a photo of her on Facebook. So the courts had already told us that there was nothing unlawful about this, about, you know, the tagging feature, that you don't need someone's permission to tag them on a Facebook photo. But what we see here is Facebook kind of playing more into the norms of what we expect in terms of privacy and in terms of the appropriate context for our image and our information, playing more into that which comports with reality, which actually is different than what the law may actually require. So I'm happy to see it for reasons other than legal ones, just to make it a more genuine user experience in which people can feel safer in terms of the larger issues of privacy, even outside of the law.
Right. Eric, do you think this is too little too late?
I agree with your earlier comment about the complexity of the privacy settings on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in academia, we talk about the accuracy-simplicity trade-off, that you can have things that are accurate or you can have things that are simple, but you normally can't have both. And to the extent that Facebook's privacy settings become more fine-grained, we face the challenge that, like you, a larger number of people simply won't use them. There's just too many configurations to worry about. I've always set my Facebook settings categorically on friends only. I did mm-hmm. that not because of privacy concerns, but because I didn't want Facebook to try and use all my links for link love for itself. You know, when you like something, for example, they create a page that you like and then they're trying to SEO it. Right. So I turned off all my public Facebook content. I post the exact same things to Twitter and to Google Plus. On Google Plus, I've set my entire stream to public, and I'm not going to try and be more granular than that. And I wonder how many people are actually making the same choice, that they just pick one setting and stick with it, at which point having greater options is great, but doesn't really matter a ton.
Right. You sort of get a notion in your head as to whether this is a service that you can trust to preserve your privacy if you are going to use the fine-grained settings or not. And I think, you know, along the way, people have definitely gotten to the point with Facebook where their trust level is pretty low. I don't know, the timing on this is fairly good, but last week, I don't know if any of you guys saw this come through from any of your friends on Facebook, but I saw a number of times people's status alerts updated to read, "Alert, new privacy issue with Facebook. As of tomorrow, Facebook will creep into your bathroom when you're in the shower, smack your ass, then steal your clothes and towel. To change this option, go to privacy settings, personal settings, bathroom settings, smacking and stealing settings, and uncheck the shenanigans box. Facebook has kept this one quiet. Copy and paste this on your status to alert the unaware." So, you know, when that kind of thing is flying around, you've got to think that the trust in the network has gone down to a pretty low level. And like you, Eric, I keep my Facebook stuff set on a default of friends only. And the other day, I actually wanted to post something public to Facebook, and I had to post it twice because it used the default settings the first time and I didn't think to change them. And then when I wanted to go in and edit it, that wasn't possible. So it had to go up twice.
Hey, Denise, one more thing.
Go ahead.
Sorry, one more point. Whether or not Facebook made its changes in response to Google Plus, there's no doubt that Google and Facebook are going toe-to-toe competitively. And that strikes me as only a good thing, that here... in this area, competition will be our friend, that we'll get better results from both companies because of the fact that they're beating up on each other. So if anything, I think seeing Google Plus have as much success as it's had will discipline Facebook in ways that it has never felt the pressure before.
Yeah. Beatmaster in the IRC has a good suggestion. Maybe the solution is to let Zynga handle the Facebook settings. And though I think that's meant humorously, at least Zynga has done its interesting Privacyville game to educate people about, I guess, how non-private their information is when they use Zynga. David, do you have any thoughts on this or on other aspects of the Facebook announcement?
So, you know, notwithstanding the whole shenanigans setting that you're talking about, I really think that the change or the continual changes in Facebook's privacy settings and privacy policies really underscores a problem with the case law that's developing around privacy and privacy settings and privacy policies. And really, the case law is that as long as you provide someone with notice that settings have changed, or give them an option to address their settings, then the company really can do whatever they want regarding privacy and privacy policies. And what you're starting to see, I think, with Facebook is a lot of privacy fatigue. So some people are going to one extreme and they're completely locking Facebook down. Others are just stopping caring. And I really think that as Facebook goes along and they continue to tinker with their privacy settings and their privacy policy, and they continually release new updates to their privacy policies, I honestly think that they are going to start drawing some suits that are hopefully, honestly, in my opinion, going to change the law related to these continual updating of privacy policies and the deemed acceptance of privacy policies just by the continued use of features. And I think that the analogy or the Facebook post that you mentioned is a great example of that. At one point, people were using Facebook and they were letting each other know about changes that were being made to Facebook settings. And now, honestly, they're made so often, particularly in the privacy setting, that it's kind of become a joke.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm interested, Eric, that you've decided to just sort of let go by the wayside all of the granularity that Google Plus offers. That, you know, until they have their first big privacy leak, which, you know, knock wood, I hope doesn't happen, Google Plus really does seem to have given you the opportunity, if you just want to share things with a small circle of people and know that it won't spread beyond there unless one of them decides to be a real jerk, that they've built that in and it seems to work nicely.
So the case law is filled with examples where content is leaked out of private conversations. So maybe I'm just gun shy because of that.
Yep.
I'm thinking about, for example, the Facebook private group discussion where five high schoolers were taunting a sixth person. They thought they were having a private conversation. One of the five of them went rogue, and lawsuits ensued accordingly. Or I teach the Moreno case, which involved a person who thought she was communicating with a very small audience on her MySpace page, and her former high school principal took her posting and had it published in the local newspaper, and gunshots ensued in addition to lawsuits. In my world, there's two types of content. There's public and non-existent content. And at least in my case, two things. I found it was overly burdensome to try and make those kinds of judgments with respect to each individual item of content. So going back to that accuracy-simplicity trade-off, I just decided I'm going for simple, forget the precision that I could have. But I've also been surprised that people who follow me wherever, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or Google+, sometimes are interested in the things that I might have thought wasn't going to be interesting to them. So I've decided as long as I try and strike the right balance among my various audiences, I just let the audience decide what they're interested in. They want to skip a post, they go for it. If not, maybe we might make a serendipitous match.
Right. That's one of the reasons I think it's odd that one of the ways people have been using Google Plus as circles is to, you know, say that, okay, I write a lot about this one topic. If you want to be in my circle to receive my posts on that topic, then let me know and I'll put you in that circle. That seems like people would lose out on the serendipitous other interesting items that someone would have to share. So I don't know. I mean, it's a noise control option that people are bolting on, since the noise on Google Plus can be rather loud. I want to get back to something David touched on a minute ago, and that is consent by sort of apathy to what's going on and deciding that the trade-off, what you get out of a site, is good enough, even though your privacy may be at risk. And bring up this Nebuad case, Eric, from your blog, and the deep packet inspection issue that it concerned. Actually, the name of the case was not Nebuad. It was Kirch v. Embark. And it seems like that case came down to users having an opt-out where, you know, if they had decided to go deep into the terms and explore exactly what was happening with their data, they could have opted out to it, out of it. But whether I'd like to ask you, Eric, whether you think the court made the right choice, that that opt-out was actually meaningful.
So I have very conflicted norms about this. There's my overarching concern that the privacy lawsuits we're seeing against internet companies are not meritorious. Whether it's based on the legal doctrines or based on simply the fact that the plaintiffs can't show any meaningful harm, whether that's legal harm or moral harm or anything. I have some deep reservations about the lawsuits we're seeing in the field. So in general, I'm sympathetic I'm comfortable when I see these lawsuits kicked out early, because chances are that that's the right result in the end from a policy standpoint. Having said that, we have seen some interesting doctrinal contortions coming from some of these cases. So in this particular case, this involved the DPAC inspection by internet access providers outsourcing to Nebuad, who was then going to be inserting different ads into the user's experience than the ones that they should have gotten. And I have always wondered about the legality of that under existing doctrine. This particular ruling turned on some pretty fine points of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. It's a law I don't understand. I know very few people who actually do. So the finer points.
If you don't understand it, Eric, we are all in trouble.
Right. You know, that's much more of a commentary on the statute than it is your ability to understand, that's for sure.
My description is one of the worst three statutes Congress has ever drafted in terms of drafting quality. It's not understandable by anyone. In some sense, it's a catch-22. The people who say that they understand it, by definition, cannot be very smart, because no smart person could ever understand that statute. So in any case, but, you know, going to the consent point that David was raising, the court definitely cut some corners on that. It was very generous to the internet access provider, both in terms of the initial disclosures and then the ability of the internet access provider to amend those disclosures over time. The court could have said, and perhaps should have said, that the internet access provider did not make adequate disclosures. And the court just seemed to wave its hand and say, I don't really have a problem with what's going on here, so I'm going to look the other way with respect to the practices of the internet access provider. So in that sense, I share David's concern that maybe we're seeing some doctrinal hacks to get to what is, in my opinion, a sound policy result.
Right. David, what do you think about that?
I agree with Eric about this issue of deep packet inspection. I have a real hard time with deep packet inspection and whether or not it's it really impacts people's individual privacy. Obviously, what's happening with these cases is that people like me, who make their living drafting privacy policies, are coming up with these privacy policies that are so intensely broad that they can capture anything. So really what you're ending up with and what courts are having to struggle with are privacy policies that in essence say, we can do almost anything we want with your private information whenever we want, as long as every once in a while we give you notice about this really broad category of data we might be having access to. And so I agree with Eric that what you're seeing is that courts are struggling very, very hard to deal with statutes that at their base are designed to give some certainty into privacy law, and particularly at the state level. This is happening a lot at the state level, but they're having a really difficult time kind of harmonizing these state statutes that try to protect privacy with these intensely broad contracts, and meshing contract law and the legislative desire to kind of rein in some of these privacy abuses.
Hey, right, David.
Well, go ahead.
Hey, David. Yep. So are you advising your clients to include in their privacy policies, we can amend this privacy policy whenever we want, and it's your responsibility to check back and figure out if we've done so?
So It's for my clients, it's really a two-step process. The privacy policies do generally give the client the opportunity to amend at any time. But quite honestly, my view of the case law that that underscores and stabilizes privacy policy is that you do need to give notice when there's an amendment to the privacy policy. You can't really just depend on your users to check back every month, every week to see if you've changed it. In looking at the case law that stabilizes privacy policies, there is some indication that you do need to give notice and it needs to be given in a meaningful way. But then you end up with a Facebook problem where you're giving notice all the time, and it's something that's becoming a problem.
So how do you advise your clients to give notice then? What mechanisms do they use to communicate with their users?
And that's actually the standard that I use. What mechanisms do you use to communicate with your clients? So what is a way that you generally communicate with your clients? And if you're making an important change to your privacy policy, you need to use those mechanisms to communicate with them.
Right. So it could be a press release. It could be a notice on the site. It could be an email, although that seems like it would be a lot of work and potentially intrusive for users.
Exactly. But the goal in this is to provide notice and to allow customers and allow clients the ability to see that a change has been made. The issue, though, with my practice as opposed to an ISP practice or the case that we're discussing is I work with businesses, and so the universe of notices that have to be given is much smaller than if you're working in a consumer context.
Got
and
it.
I would add, Denise, I'm sorry, I would add
Go
that,
ahead.
You know, in Facebook's case, their privacy practices are so closely scrutinized. All they have to do is post something online and people are going to freak out no matter what. But for many internet companies, their privacy practices are not carefully scrutinized. And the burden might be on them to be more aggressive about getting the word out to their users. I personally think that user agreements and privacy policies are an especially poor way of trying to educate users about what's going on and what they should expect. And so in some sense, I might suggest the burden is on those companies to really get the word out in a way that users can appreciate if they want to make clear to the users what the deal is.
Evan, how would you feel if you were being deep packet inspected and had not thought to go check for an opt-out box?
Yeah, I don't like the TSA at all. But oh, that's not this story. That was a different one. Sorry. Am I frozen up on your video too? I'm like, at least it's a decent shot there. So, this is one of those questions where it seems like what happens at the internet service provider level is shrouded in so much more mystery than what goes on when you're using some kind of web platform or website like Facebook or something like that. Because, you know, your interactions with them are right there. And the information that you are disclosing to them is the information that you actually post on the site, for example, you know, Facebook, you know, your connections and your photos and stuff like that. But so it's a little bit more ominous when you think about the ISP looking at the packets of information that are going through the system in, you know, this big monolithic building somewhere in the black box. And so to me, it's kind of different in nature in such a way that perhaps there should be somewhat of a different treatment when it comes to the way that data is treated at the internet service provider level rather than at the web service provider level, because the information is so much more fundamental. It's so much more comprehensive because it's all of your web traffic, not all of your internet traffic, not just the traffic or the particular information that you would choose to disclose to one site. So in a certain sense, it's almost as if that characteristic of it, the mystery, the shroudedness of the information and the comprehensiveness really merits sincere scrutiny as to what the privacy understanding of the user is at that level, at the ISP kind of level.
Right. Well, this is not the only recent case that has come down against a plaintiff in a privacy-related action. As long as we're talking about deep packet inspection, we may as well discuss flash cookies and history sniffing. Eric, you had another action, the Bose versus InterClick case that that Venkat wrote about on your site, and you weighed in with some very cogent comments. Why don't you bring us up to speed on that one?
So there's been a variety of lawsuits over different ways that websites place cookies on users' computers. We had those lawsuits going back over a decade. The INRI DoubleClick lawsuit from 2001 basically said there's no viable cause of action for placing ordinary cookies onto users' computers. But marketers keep coming up with new ways of placing cookies or other unique identifiers on users' computers. And I would point out that technologically, increasingly, people may be able to uniquely identify a computer without any cookie of any sort. For example, the EFF put out a nice report about how people could determine a unique computer based on its browser configuration and settings, at which point then you don't need to place anything on a user's computer, can still figure them out. But meanwhile, people are still putting cookies, and they get new names because they become increasingly scary. So there's the flash cookie, which comes in via flash as opposed to the web browser. Or there's the super cookies, which people talk about, which allegedly respawn themselves even if you've deleted the cookie. And I think, we're kind of like, the marketers go us through the tiers of their promotional levels. You start out with your bronze, silver, gold, platinum, titanium. We're kind of going through that with the cookies. Each cookie variation we get is becoming increasingly more scary. But the overarching problem from a legal standpoint is that it's not clear how any cookie causes any user any harm. It takes up a de minimis amount of space on the user's computer, and the tracking might be objectionable, but may not cause the user any harm that we can recognize as a legal standpoint. So we've now had a couple of cases that have tossed out lawsuits over unwanted cookies because the plaintiffs could not allege a sufficient harm. They didn't like it. They should not have been forced to take cookies they didn't want, but the law has nothing for them.
Right, and it seems like the judge in this case was really unsympathetic to this kind of claim at all, going so far as to say that even if the plaintiff had taken steps to prevent the cookies and the data collection, it would still be insufficient to assert a claim that, if you'd actually taken affirmative steps to use a cookie blocker or one of these browser extensions that purports to protect you from being tracked, and that the defendant had taken the additional step of trying to disable those measures, it still would not be actionable. That strikes me, we're talking about claims that are kind of buckled onto this situation that may not have been designed for them, such as trespass to chattels. But it seems to me that you start messing around with somebody's property at some point when you're going that far. What do you think, David?
Well, actually, I was going to follow up, particularly with your comment on trespass to chattels. I honestly wonder when one of these trespass to chattels suits or claims is going to work. All of these suits seem to have trespass to chattels claims in them. And quite honestly, the vast majority of judges just swat them down. I don't know. I honestly don't know why they keep being included in these suits. So that's one thing that I was thinking about in both of these cases. The other thing that I was thinking about is in Eric's blog, I guess Venkat made a comment kind of along the lines of, where is the FTC in all of this? And that's something that I saw in the Kirsch decision, actually in the InterClick decision, where the judge was talking about unfair and deceptive trade practices. And I do think in some of these privacy and advertising suits, there is a really a good role here for the FTC dealing with unfair and deceptive trade practices. And I really do wonder where they are and why these claims are not being made maybe at the federal level.
David, if I can just jump in on that, that's a great point. And I would point out, for example, that the FTC brought an enforcement action against Chatika for promising that it would remove users' cookies and then only doing so for 10 days. Now, that was a mistake on their part, or so they claim. But the FTC said, if you're going to give people the option to remove it, you can't then only remove it for 10 days. That violates people's expectations. And so the FTC is paying attention to cookie problems and where people are being misled. That very well may be within the FTC's ken.
Right. Eric, you had some comments at the end here that were sort of a smackdown for both sides of the case, that plaintiffs should not be bringing lawsuits over cookies because ever since DoubleClick, they've gone nowhere, and that ad networks should not be trampling on people's expressed preferences and expectations. But at the same time, we don't know that legislation is the best way to ensure that they don't. That it seems like your message to them is just do it without being compelled to do it. Do you really think that, that's going to work?
I have a hope, but I have no expectation. And I would point out that ad networks live in a very funky zone because they have all these direct interactions with users, but we can't say that users have a business relationship with them. It's not like the users choose which ad networks to participate in. And the ad networks have no branding visibility to consumers. It doesn't matter if the consumers trust the ad networks or not. So there's no disciplining factor in the ad network industry that comes from consumers. It only comes from the publishers they work with acting as a proxy for consumer interest. And because of that, ad networks can do a lot of things under the hood. Nobody ever knows about them. No one cares about them until they discover them. And in that sense, there is no incentive for self-regulation. But, you know, it just seems very basic to me. If a user gives you more information about what they want and don't want, failing to respect that is just illogical. It doesn't make any sense. And failing to respect it is also, as David points out, a potential FTC problem. But more importantly, it's just going to force the regulators to sweep into the industry. And the ad networks will unquestionably be worse off. So I hope they get the message, but I'm not optimistic.
This case, although I share your concern, Eric, that we not have a flurry of these cases by plaintiffs for any number of reasons, this one seemed compelling because of the argument that the plaintiff was trying to make, that this is my data and it's valuable and I should be able to control what's done with it and I should be able to benefit from that value, and that the court was not going for that concept. Evan, that's something we've discussed on the show quite a bit. And I think that the spin in this case takes it out of the frivolous kind of suit. Do you agree?
Well, I guess so. And on that point, what I interpreted the court saying was that those weren't the kind of damages that the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act would talk about. You know, the it would only provide for economic damages, the things that actually you're damaged by because your computer system is messed up. And that to a certain extent, it's a bit you know, to make that kind of argument under something like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a little bit anomalous, but that doesn't obscure the fact, or that certainly does not change the fact, that that value, whether it be economic value in terms of what remedies the law will provide or something else, there's that certain dignitary value of that information that ought to be addressed somewhere. And, you know, with cases like this, it's a tough sell because the disclosure of this quote-unquote private information is not one that results in great harm to the person. It's not like some, you know, very private fact or some other disclosure that would be so emotionally wrenching on the person that it would cause them to need to go seek therapy and go on medication and all that stuff. This is much more benign, that this type of information here. So that's one reason why it doesn't play out well in a case like this. But given the appropriate context and given, if it doesn't fit into some kind of statutory framework like the ECPA or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, it's harder to say where we would actually put that. And maybe it's that point on which we need, as the other commentators on this in this caller are talking about, where is the FTC's role in all of this? The FTC should implement something that takes care of that consumer interest in some form.
Right. The real world analogy, and maybe it's not a perfect one, is, you know, I'm conceiving of data in these cases and information as a form of property. They're not really recognized that way by the law. And so we get these discussions under various statutes that don't really apply. But I think that we need to move toward a place where it's just as nefarious to come in and snatch someone's data without their consent and without compensation as it is to come in and snatch their goods. Eric, do you think that we'll ever get to that point?
I don't know if you're setting me up here, Denise, or not. As you may know, I disagree with your viewpoint strongly, and I am emphatically against thinking about personal data as property. And I wrote a lengthy article on this back in 2006. Can I dump the link in the chat room, or am I going to
give people... Absolutely, yeah.
I'll put the link in the chat room to the article that I wrote where I talked about this. My broad outline is that personal data is just an input into marketers trying to better solve consumer needs. And we don't want to propertize that input because it will actually prevent the marketers from doing things that would be socially valuable to us. We may decide that there are certain outer boundaries of behavior that we have to restrict. But in the main, the whole point of marketers collecting data is to do a better job of trying to anticipate our needs. And we want them to do that. And we should make it easier for marketers and consumers to make matches with each other, not to make it harder. So I will lay out a lengthy defense of that point in the chat room, but certainly I'm not on the same wavelength as you in terms of either that we need to go there or that would be an advisable thing.
Okay, point taken. I just, you know, would wonder whether such a broad perspective is appropriate. Not everybody would buy into the kind of ecosystem you just described, and the opt-outs, I think, to that need to be meaningful and obvious if we're going to go forward that way.
Well, I'm sorry, Denise, to chime in on that some more.
Yeah.
Ultimately, this is something where technology can solve many of our problems. Now, we're having an arms race over the placement of cookies. You might say that some people are taking technological steps to suppress the cookies. And then with these respawning cookies, the marketers are trying to bypass express instructions of the users. So we do have these arms races, but there's a number of ways that technology can, and I think will ultimately facilitate matches between marketers and consumers without the collateral damage of consumers feeling like they've lost control. And again, I lay out some of those in my paper that I'm about to post in the chat room.
Great. Thank you for that. Evan, what was your thought?
Well, can't we all just get along? You two stop fighting over this stuff. The connection that I'm seeing, and I don't know where you're wanting to take the conversation, Denise, here, but I'm reminded when we're talking about this idea of what it is as consumers, what our expectations are when we're perhaps inadvertently or I guess unknowingly disclosing information to marketers, or, you know, I guess we're not even doing it unknowingly, but what's the word I'm looking for? We're not always aware of the scope to which we're disclosing information about ourselves, especially in the composite when it's taken and it's mined and it's, and connections are made about our preferences and stuff like that, that we aren't aware are being made. I'm reminded of the similar issue or I see a similarity to the issue here of what our expectation is on the location data that we're constantly transmitting about ourselves and what our Fourth Amendment interest is in that, or more generally, what our privacy interest is in that. So there's a certain analogy that can be made as to what our expectations are and what sort of right that we have in that information that we are not fully aware of the extent to which it's being disclosed. And there was, you know, a recent decision from a federal court that held that, you know, for there, that there is a Fourth Amendment interest and a warrant is required for the law enforcement to get information that tracks a person's location from their cell phone, that data that's transmitted over time. So there's a certain commonality there. And whether we characterize that as a property interest or as a privacy interest, it's something that is personal. And I think it's worth examining kind of that interplay. What is the role and what rights does the individual have in determining how that information is used, whether you characterize it in terms of property or privacy? I see that connection in some sense.
Right. Hold those thoughts, because I want to get to what the government can find out about us. We've been talking about what marketers and businesses can. And talk about that case where a warrant was required for getting at cell location data. But first, I want to go ahead and thank our sponsor for this show, which is Netflix, which is something that I basically cannot and definitely would choose not to live without. And especially its new instant streaming services, which stream you thousands of TV episodes and movies to whatever device you may be using at the time. You know, we could start watching something here in another tab on my browser, but I won't do that to you guys. But wherever you are, whether you've got your phone or your mobile computer or your tablet device, you can access those streaming movies and TV shows anywhere where you're online. You can watch on your Mac, your PC, your iPad. You can watch on any game console that you might have, the Xbox 360, the PS3, the Wii, all support it. And if you're not a gamer, all the other wonderful set-top boxes that are on the market these days, including Roku and Apple TV, will definitely bring Netflix right to you wherever you want it. And you can begin watching the movie on one device and then finish it on a different one. So it's nice that it's tracking you in that way, Eric. I'm giving you an example of one way of making it convenient for people to have their data tracked. Whichever way you choose to use Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. The DVD delivery service, of course, is still there. The instant streaming service just makes it all the more convenient and instant gratification. And if you're not already using Netflix, you can get it 30 days for free. Why wouldn't you do it? Go to netflix.com/twit, and that way you'll tell them that we sent you there, which we really appreciate. And we really appreciate Netflix's support of Twit and This Week in Law. Okay, so we did have this interesting case where courts have been sort of all over the map with how law enforcement could get at cell location data. We've got a Judge Nicholas Garoufis, if I'm not butchering his name too badly, in New York, a district judge in New York, who has decided that months of location data on a suspect that was sought by law enforcement couldn't just be forked over without a warrant. Evan, since you were bringing up the policy issues around this, why don't you kick off our discussion?
Well, I liked this decision. It's a very pro-privacy decision, and I like it most of all because the judge actually talks some common sense. If I could just read a little bit of passage from the opinion, and this was actually mentioned in the Ars Technica piece on it. The judge says the fiction that the vast majority of Americans consent to warrantless government access merely by choosing to carry a cell phone must be rejected. I like that because we don't always know, and we have no way of really finding out the extent to which information about our location is being collected and saved and stored in the big electronic brains that our wireless network providers have. And, you know, there's this, we should be concerned to the extent that, that it's a porous interface between that information and the government who could go seek to get it here. So this decision from this judge, I think, is important because it recognizes, the clearest I've ever seen it be recognized, this problem that we have in 21st century, in the 21st century with 21st century technologies, the problems that we face when we try to put old Fourth Amendment jurisprudence into this, for example, the idea that once you disclose information to a third party or once something is provided to a third party, you lose your right of privacy in that. I'm oversimplifying it, but that's the third party doctrine in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. In the age of where we are now, when we are a networked society and when we rely so much on intermediaries and service providers and hosted solutions and cloud computing and software as a service and all that stuff, it's insane to think that we should apply those old doctrines, which would dictate that you lose your privacy interest if something is outside of, you know, the four walls of where you are within your immediate control. It's insane to think that you would lose that by placing that with a third-party provider. So this decision recognizes that and rejects the notion that that the government should just be given a blank check to come in and get whatever provider information without the warrant requirement, which protects our privacy interests under the Fourth Amendment. So that's why I like this decision.
You guys will have to remind me or enlighten me. Aren't we dealing with a world where it's very easy for law enforcement to go to cell providers? They actually have set up portals for law enforcement to go and obtain exactly this kind of data for a small fee and without a warrant. And so, Eric, let's start with you. Do you think that this case is a threat to that kind of arrangement? And are we headed for the Supreme Court ultimately with this one?
Great case, but until we see other rulings reinforcing it, it's hard to get too excited. It's amazing how many judges are very sympathetic to the prosecutor's needs and put very light constraints on what the government can do. So I guess I'm still reserving judgment about the implications of this case. I do think that anything that puts greater handcuffs on the government to obtain information that is automatically generated by our normal day-to-day activities makes complete sense. And I would point out that there's also been an effort afoot to amend the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which would also statutorily apply to many of the issues we're discussing, to fix the fact that we store a lot of personal data in the cloud, and it should be as if it's within our possession and control. But right now, the law distinguishes between data on our hard drive and data that we put into a private cloud locker. And that doesn't make any sense either, and I'm hoping we will fix that problem too.
From a web host standpoint, David, what do you think of the warrant case and Eric's comments about distinguishing between the cloud and local storage?
So, you know, I think that in most cases, most hosts and most infrastructure providers actually are very good about requiring warrants and kind of following the letter of the law as it is. But I do agree with Eric that the courts tend to lean very hard towards law enforcement, and you tend to see that quite a bit when you're dealing with warrants and processing subpoenas. They're very easily granted. You know, I actually really didn't like that this case. No offense to Evan. Honestly, I looked at this case as the judge really trying to tee up a review by the Supreme Court, or tee up the issue for review by the Supreme Court. I really think that there was kind of a flawed analysis in this case. I think that it looked, it ignored the length of time that had gone by with the records. I also think that in some cases, it honestly ignored the validity of stakeouts and those types of things. But the one thing that it did do that I really do like is that there was a discussion about whether something is content or not content, and kind of an unpacking of this argument about dissecting what is content, what is not content. So trying to get away from the analysis that you have in the Electronic Communications Privacy Act regarding open and unopen mail and those types of distinctions. So that's what I really liked about it. And from an internet infrastructure perspective, the more clarity that they can get on these issues will be better.
Hey, David.
Yep.
Sorry to jump in again, Denise. What do your clients do when they get a defective subpoena? It was my experience, now this is a little bit dated, that we would routinely get defective subpoenas, that the government actually rarely sent us a subpoena that clearly complied with the law. Maybe that's changed, but to the extent it hasn't, what are your clients doing with these defective subpoenas?
Defective subpoenas are sent back to the issuing officers. My clients, to the extent that I do this for them, we review every subpoena and every warrant to ensure that it complies with the underlying statutory authority. And if it's defective, it goes back. I honestly don't see very many defective warrants or subpoenas. And quite honestly, when we do go back to the law enforcement official, they turn around very quickly and issue a valid document.
Okay. So, David, we're talking about government access to data, and of course, the Patriot Act is a big old check that the government wrote itself to being able to access all kinds of data. You had sent in a link about a French web host. It looks to me as though, and for anyone, I'm going to just put in an aside here, for anyone interested in the scope of the Patriot Act and its effect beyond the borders of the United States and how European and other countries and data hosters have to respond to it, Zach Whitaker over at ZDNet has looked into this in depth and has a wonderful series of articles and thoughts and considerations on it. So I encourage you to go and Google up Zach Whitaker and Patriot Act, and you'll find tons and tons of information on this. But this particular example was a French web host that looks like they've chosen sort of a complete isolation separation strategy, that the way they're going to ensure that any customers using their French services are not subject to the Patriot Act is they are sequestering all of their hardware, software, services, et cetera, from anything to do with the United States. Am I getting that right?
Yes, exactly. That's the way they've structured their corporate operations. And what I really like about this blog post, this, and it's from OVH, which is a big French hoster that recently opened an office, or actually a facility in California. What I really like about this post is it is a great example of the use of the Patriot Act for marketing. Honestly, when I talk to Europeans and European businesses, I spend about half the time during my discussion talking about the Patriot Act and how the Patriot Act works. The Patriot Act was the best piece of marketing for non-US infrastructure businesses that the Congress could have handed them. And what they do is they use fear of the Patriot Act to drive business. And so in this case, if you look at the blog post, really what OVH is saying is they're looking at the Patriot Act and they're making the analogy, or they're saying that a police officer can literally show up at a business's office and just say something like, "Surprise, Patriot Act." And all of a sudden, the business has to turn over hard drives. And it really capitalizes on the fear and misunderstanding of the Patriot Act. What I don't think is really understood is the interconnectedness between law enforcement agencies and law enforcement entities around the world. And the fact that a company creates this corporate isolation does not necessarily insulate their users' data in another country. So, for example, Privacy International has done a really great study of laws around the world relating to privacy and private data. And they use an example of RIPA statute or a law in the UK that provides for warrantless seizures of data. And their statistics show that in I guess 2010, there were over 500,000 warrantless searches of data in the UK alone. So I think that this is really important, because what it shows is that the Patriot Act is not really the only statute and that makes it very easy for law enforcement to gain data in a quick manner. And while I really do like the concept of corporate separation, for a number of reasons, the capitalization on the fear of the Patriot Act is what I think is just kind of amazing outside of the U.S.
I think I agree with you, and it's great that you point that out. The marketing aspect of the Patriot Act is not exactly what is the first thing that comes to mind. The complete separation isolation strategy, I think, is sad and economically retrograde in today's day and age, that we've forced companies to build these sort of artificial walls to try and escape the reach of foreign data probing. Eric, do you have any thoughts on that?
This is a complicated issue. We've seen so much movement here in the United States involving internet companies doing business in repressive regimes, where we have been goading and threatening to require that the companies make a choice, comply with the progressive repressive regime's laws and suffer the consequences here, or pull out of that industry altogether. And so I think we're talking about that without talking about it. And my only observation is that I think the U.S. government is entirely hypocritical on this front. When we do things that cut short due process or require companies to act as private censors, we think that's swell. And when any other countries do it, we think that they don't understand the First Amendment principles that are the bedrock of our country.
Right. Evan, any thoughts on this before we move on?
No, it's just a dangerous one to talk about, really, because, you know, we could really easily get into ideas of American exceptionalism and, you know, are our standards somehow going to be the ones who should be applied? You know, I mean, we do have national security interests that are important, and, you know, I don't have any interest personally in compromising our national security interests in what, you know, a French company is going to say and how it's going to market to its customers. But at the same time, I recognize we don't want to be overreaching, and we don't want the Patriot Act to be something that is objectively silly, whether it is you know, based on legitimate American security interests or otherwise. So I honestly don't know what to say. It's just got to be that's got to be the analysis of it.
Alrighty. We can't do a This Week in Law without touching on intellectual property in some way, and we've somehow managed to do that so far this episode. So let's get to some IP-related stuff. We had our two patent lawyers on last week and none on this week, so we're just going to have to bring this up for its entertainment value more than the actual rigorous analysis any of us can probably lend to it. But there's a wonderful bit of news this week that Samsung, in its case against Apple, its opposition to Apple's motion for preliminary injunction against sales of the Galaxy S, Infuse 4G, Droid Charge, and Galaxy Tab 10.1, is claiming that the video device depicted in 2001, A Space Odyssey, is actually prior art. So they're going after the substance of the patents themselves based on a movie, which is just amazing to me. But as people were discussing it this week, and Patrick Igo, who is a patent lawyer in particular, has some posts on this, that there is actually some merit to claiming something from a movie as prior art that can challenge a patent. He's talking about enablement being the key that As long as the pictures and drawing are enabling art, then they can actually be something that you can go after a patent with. Eric, are you? What do you think about this? Do you think that this has a prayer at all?
Whether it does or not, it's clearly a publicity stunt to point out that our media depictions from 45 years ago, if I'm remembering correctly, anticipated things people are claiming under patent today. It really makes that point very well. One of my colleagues pointed out that actually the tablets look a lot more like the devices in Star Trek, particularly Star Trek The Next Generation. So whether it's in 2001 or in Star Trek The Next Generation, the point is that a lot of the technology we're talking about isn't impossible to conceive of. It had already been thought out. The reference you made about enablement kind of cuts a corner there. It's easy enough to describe doing things in science fiction that no one could ever possibly enable, and those don't do very much from a prior art standpoint. So, saying that it would turn on enablement doesn't really answer the question whether it will work, but it does certainly make the patent owners look a little bit silly that they're trying to assert patents over things that people have been talking about for decades.
Right. Well, I mean, if you look at science fiction as a whole, Star Trek, for example, the communicators were basically cell phones. But you can't say that all the rest of the cell phone manufacturers have to have their patents invalidated simply because Captain Kirk was flicking open his communicator and asking Scotty to beam him up. David, any thoughts on this?
My only thought is I can't believe that these motion pictures really become enablement. That's looking at the patent manual and seeing that was something that I'd never thought of before. That's my only thought about it.
Matt McCarry, who is a real live patent lawyer and who is in our IRC right now, says these are design patents, so enablement is easy with a picture. Who knows? I guess it's worth throwing at the wall in the lawsuit and seeing if it sticks. Evan, any thoughts on opening the pad bay door?
Sure. That's good. What Matt McCarry, our friend who you were talking about there, mentioning that, that since these are design patents, that changes the analysis. He wrote a great blog post on his blog, Litigating Apple, that kind of, for me, puts this in perspective of what's going on here. I mean, there is a plan A and a plan B in attacking these or in raising these defenses. And so the use of the clip from the Stanley Kubrick flick is obviously a plan C. And I think you're characterizing it well by saying they're throwing it up against the wall and seeing what sticks. To plan C, relying on plan A and plan B, the other good arguments to actually carry the day. And, and it gets us talking about it. This is a pretty mundane issue otherwise. So, it's keeping it a topic of conversation for us. So it's good in that respect.
It does indeed. Something I have not seen too much conversation on yet because it's still in beta and invite only. The conversation I have seen around it is just what an awesome service and people really enjoying it is turntable.fm. Have you guys tried that out? Eric, have you gone in there and DJed any tracks yet?
Yeah, I'm sure that people will love to hear me DJing. No, sorry, I haven't. Although if we end up talking about Spotify, I have been playing around with Spotify, and I'd be happy to talk about that.
Sure. Well, as far as I know, their legal ducks are all in a row. They've got all their licensing more than sewn up, and they've got a patent case out there pending against them, but Spotify's not that interesting from the legal standpoint because they've actually signed everyone up. I think Turntable, on the other hand, is sort of hanging its hat on some combination of what lets Pandora operate. Of course, Pandora went and got all its licensing in order as well. But they're on the concept that you're not able to actually select what you're hearing on Turntable. It's just, track after track of other people's selections. So you're not dialing up a particular song and able to hear it. So it seems to be, that's one leg of their legal table. And then The other one, you know, I'm not even sure if there is another leg. Maybe though, they're hinging on the lockering cases that are out there and the cloud music services such as Amazon and Google. And if those are blessed without licensing, then perhaps Turntable will be too. But at this point, I think it's interesting to watch because it is a growing service that has got a lot of buzz and a lot of compelling functionality, and the legal side of it seems to be pretty tenuous. David, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Well, first of all, I didn't know about this until you included a link, and so I think I have you to blame for sucking up half of my morning playing around on Turntable. It's actually a very cool service. But in playing around with it and looking at it, you know, in some respects, some of what's going on here really makes me think of public performance with people DJing, whether they're DJing from their private lockers or they're DJing some other way. You know, unless you have a closed room, it really kind of strikes me as public performance. So I do wonder about how they're going to handle that issue in dealing with the record companies.
Right. Zadiva has had trouble with that recently. So I don't know that one necessarily bodes well for Turntable's future. Evan, what do you think of this example of asking forgiveness, not permission?
Yeah, maybe there's something to be said about how YouTube went about it in its relationship with the various record labels. You know, built up this huge service with millions of users, you know, much to the chagrin of the content industry. But now there are ways, most of them, if not all of these ways of working out licensing arrangements and revenue sharing through automatic technological means. You know, recognizing what music is present there, you know, being used. Maybe there's some iteration of that could come about here, where everybody wins, everybody gets a piece of the pie. Recognizing the popularity of it and the inherent appeal because of the sociality of it all. It would be a shame just to see it shut down. There are plenty of ways that people could think creatively of how to monetize this and even split up to the pie and give a few pieces to, you know, those mean old members of the content industry. Who knows?
Right. As long as we're on music, I haven't really looked too closely at the MP3 tunes decision, but if you have, Evan, maybe you could bring us up to speed there.
Well, I have, and I'm going to defer. I'm going to look for help from David and from Eric on this. But it was kind of a mixed ruling, and Eric, I know you wrote about it. But the what we get essentially is a holding. MP3 Tunes, as we know, is this locker service, and it had the side loading feature. And what we get as a holding is that they were entitled to DMCA protection for certain aspects of the service. You know, the DMCA safe harbor immunity for certain aspects of it. They did, you know, have a repeat infringer policy in place that the court found was effective, but it was not perfectly implemented because they did not fully remove the infringing tracks from the locker service, but only removed the links to those things. What else? You know, I've just read through the case once. Eric, you've actually written about it. What I was having a hard time figuring out the $64,000 question of how this actually translates into, you know, the future for the cloud music providers like Amazon and Apple and Google. That's a point where I'm a little bit unclear because of the mixed ruling. So I need to kick it over to Eric or David on this. Eric, I know you wrote about it.
Yeah, but I don't think I'm going to answer your $64,000 question because I'm unclear myself. I think the biggest takeaway was that the record label in this case sent sent takedown notices that were overclaimed compared to what they could request under the statute. And the court said, to the extent that you were within the statute and met the statutory elements, that was fine. But all the overclaiming is garbage. Don't do that. But at the same time, the more interesting piece was how MP3 Tunes handled the takedown notice. As you point out, Evan, they took down the links, but they didn't take down any files that had been stored from those links, even though they could trace the origin of those stored files to the link. So they knew which files had been downloaded from the links that they were now blocking. And it really raises a conflict between the takedown policies and the notion of private lockers. The idea behind private locker is it's like my hard drive. Nobody should be able to take things off of it. And under the online safe harbors, it seems to suggest that it isn't like your hard drive. And the service provider must take down the files from your private locker. So, you know, as you're going around on the internet and archiving things for your personal enjoyment, if you put it in the cloud, this case seems to suggest that it might not be there the next time you go back. And I think that's troubling. And I think that MP3 Tunes was trying to avoid that result, and they got their hands slapped because of that.
David, have you been following along with Michael Robertson's businesses since MP3.com? And are you do you have any other thoughts on this case?
Well, you know, there were four things that I liked in this case. The first thing, as Eric pointed out, is this slapping down of the overbroad DMCA notices, where here we're going to give you 100 links and we're going to say, and everything else. I really liked that aspect of it. Another thing that I really liked was the discussion of the file sharing and saying that it was not inherently infringing. You know, that's something that the RIAA and the MPAA are really going after. They really want courts to start determining to hold that these services are inherently infringing. And, you know, you really only need look as far as the domain name seizures, the affidavits that back those up, to see where they're going with that. I also like the decision regarding search engines, that you typing something into a search engine or the search engine that they used, the fact that they indexed possibly infringing works was not itself bad. And the final thing was that EMI acknowledged that it distributes songs for free and in some cases had no way of knowing whether it had the right to claim ownership in those songs. So there were four things that I really liked in this decision.
Good. Well, thank you for summarizing those for us. I have some updates on some things we've talked about recently on the show, just so that we are complete and follow up on the things that we cover. Last week, we talked about, I think it was last week, we talked about a law in Missouri that, if enacted, would prevent teachers from being able to have anything but public discussions with students on social media sites like Facebook, any other kind of web forum. It would need to happen not in an exclusive kind of way. It would need to be in public. A judge has actually stepped in and blocked that law from taking effect because of the free speech concerns involved. And so I guess that it will be shelved at least until February. That's how long it's enjoined anyway. And they presumably will take a closer look at it and see if it can be tweaked. I think it's interesting, too. I haven't really considered it until just now, but there's a privacy issue here as well. If you're forcing students to have their online interactions with teachers in a public forum, that's, you know, taking in many cases minors and maybe even people under the age of 13, and making their online discourse more public than maybe they or their parents would like it to be. So I'm happy that this law looks like it'll get a second look. And then another thing to follow up on that we discussed last week, having to do with commercial speech and how far the government can go in requiring cigarette companies to put things on their packaging that they otherwise would never do because it's intended to dissuade people from buying the actual item. We got an email from a listener, Chuck, in Thailand, who wrote in to let us know that in Thailand, they have a regime in place that is much like the FDA regulations here in the United States that will go into effect in September of next year, where these really heinous photos of things that can happen from smoking are actually featured on the packaging. We have an example of one here. This is what Chuck sent me on it from a package of cigarettes he picked up in Thailand of somebody's terribly ulcerated foot. Okay, we can make that go away now, please. But they have, he says that they've put photos like this on cigarette packs in Thailand for many years now, and he doesn't think it has any effect either way on curbing smokers. He thinks it's only helping out the printing business there, and he's got no fear at all of getting smoker's foot, regardless of what's going on the packaging. So thank you, Chuck, for that. We have a couple of good tips this week coming up. We've got our resource of the week we'll start out with. I thought this was a pretty interesting development. It's called a non-LG legal resources for anonymous people from the National Lawyers Guild. So if you are a hacker, a leaker, a hacktivist seeking representation either to preserve your anonymity or to combat whatever legal action you may be subject to despite your anonymity, there is a whole organization for you, AnonLG, that is behind your actions and it wants to help you protect your rights. So that's there for them. And then, of course, we can't talk about legal resources for anonymous people without mentioning that the anonymous group itself came up with a rap video. And maybe, Jeff, we could play a bit of that for the folks on the show, if you have that one queued.
They call themselves anonymous. They are hackers on steroids.
Police say they have arrested three suspected hackers believed to be part of an international network.
A group calling themselves anonymous has vowed to destroy the Church of Scientology.
Anonymous, the group responsible for Operation Payback, which temporarily crippled the websites of MasterCard, Visa, and PayPal.
We are Legion.
We are anonymous.
Distributed denial of service to blob the stack with rap when DOS attacks. Suits without a head get scared and shit. They slashy what we lack. A sense of compassion. A justice must be swift. How
So not only are you able to protect your identities, etc., but hopefully AnonLG will also provide any legal services related to IP infringement that they may be necessary from your anonymous rapping and sampling activities. Finally, this tip of the week was mentioned also on last week's This Week in Tech, but it's so worth sharing. We had to help the cause and bring it up here too, particularly because Evan told me he was among the large percentage of people who never do this, and that is Control F. That there's
I was afraid of what you were going to say there.
Yeah.
Thanks for making it benign.
Yes, exactly. Over on Slashdot, there's a post about Google search anthropologist Dan Russell saying that 90% of the people in his studies don't know how to use Control F to find a word in a document or a web page. And, you know, I use Control F so frequently that it's almost second nature, and I don't really remember to tell people if they're not using it. But I guess Dan Russell spreads the love and is spreading the gospel of Control F, and we're here to do the same and tell you it's the law. Ernie Swenson talks about this a lot, that if you're going to use the web at all, that you really have to familiarize yourself with the shortcuts that make life efficient, especially if you're someone who charges by the hour like a lawyer. Eric, do you think that a lot of people you come into contact with in the profession or in academia or in the dark about Control F?
I was shocked by that finding. I couldn't believe it. So maybe I'm part of the cognoscenti and therefore blind to those who aren't. But I just can't believe that many people haven't learned a very basic tool. But if that's true, then perhaps this is some kind of Darwinian thing, you know, that those of us who know and love Control F will just be able to leapfrog all the rest.
Right. The one thing I found in there that is a great resource, I think, from that /.post is that Google has a whole section of lesson plans. If you go to Google Web Search Education /lesson plans, this looks like, you know, not just a great resource to point people toward if they're not already using Control F, but for anyone who has contact with their children's schools, this would be a great thing to put in front of them, because I'd love to see kids getting this kind of grounding in their use of the web. So with the reference to /., you guys, I'm not sure which was bigger news this week, whether Steve Jobs stopped helming Apple or whether Commander Taco and Jeff Bates stopped helming /.. And I'm wondering, you guys think there's any connection between the two? I mean, they certainly are big monumental steps. Evan, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I'll miss seeing those names on /.. That's probably going to affect my day-to-day reading much more than Steve Jobs not being at Apple.
Right. How about you, David? Are you a /.?
I am, and I like your comparison there. I'm always one for a good conspiracy theory, so I do think that there's something going on here.
Yes. Well, one never knows, but one seems to have gotten a lot of coverage and one slightly less, and I don't know that that's necessarily sound journalism. Eric, any thoughts?
No, but many thanks to the heads of /.  for all the work they did. I still read /.. I know it's become a little bit retro to do so, but you know, without them, it won't be as interesting.
That's true. That's true. Well, we wish them well. And with that, you guys, I know we had a bunch of stuff on deck for today. We're kind of running out of time here, but if there's anything else that was a pet issue that we didn't cover, I'll throw it around to you, or anything else on your mind before we go ahead and wrap the show. Evan, I'll start with you.
I guess the only thing I would have wanted to talk about is how creepy it was that they found a photo album full of pictures of Condoleezza Rice and Muammar Gaddafi's stuff. It's kind of weird.
Yes, quite creepy. But I guess good diplomats are made in many ways. so if that's it on your end, Evan, then I'll go ahead and say thank you, too, for joining us this week on the show. It's been wonderful having you back.
Hey, well, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, and I've really enjoyed our conversation, as always.
Yes. InternetCases.com is Evan's home off Twill, and he's Internet Cases on Twitter. David, is there anything we didn't get to that you were burning to discuss?
You know, I don't think I can top Evan's statement. So I think that we've covered everything that that needs to be covered this week.
I think we have. All right. Well, you can look for David's writing over at it's the Web Host Industry Report, correct?
Web Host Industry Review, the word.
Review. Wonderful. And it's been great having you on the show. You're full of good insights, and I hope it was not too intimidating. We try not to be.
It was great. Thank you so much for letting me come.
Great. And what is your Twitter identity as well, if people want to follow you there?
It's WDSneedPC.
There we go. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Eric, you continue to live up to never not awesome. You're just our most not awesome guest ever.
And, I'm going to be putting that on my tombstone. I think, Evan, you'll live with me in perpetuity.
Yeah.
Right on.
We need to get you a little sign. It can just go on your desk right next to your nameplate. Little footnote to Professor Goldman, never not awesome.
And, well, it's always a pleasure being a part of the program, and I'm always grateful for the invitation. So thanks for including me.
Thanks so much for coming. And of course, you can find Eric and wonderful contributors over at his blog, blog.ericgoldman.com. And Eric Goldman on...
I'm sorry, Denise, URL problem there.
Sorry.
blog.ericgoldman.org.
.org.
I've not been able to wrest ericgoldman.com out of the hands of another Eric Goldman.
All right. Well, we will definitely find you at the right URL. And Eric Goldman on both Google Plus and Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
All right. Wonderful having this chat with you guys today. We look forward to next week's This Week in Law on September 2nd, where I'm working on doing a Hollywood-oriented show. We'll see if that works out. But in the meantime, you can follow along and see what we're putting in for discussion next week, either by following me on Google Plus or going over to the Facebook page for This Week in Law, which is facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. And until next week, we'll see you then. And we wish you all the best for the weekend. Take care.